it's, you know, it's pretty stressful. So you start sprinting and then the balls are released and you're on your own basically against bulls and a bunch of people. There's so many people and big bulls with huge horns. I was pushed towards a wall and then there was a bunch of people on top of me and there was a bull there too.
Welcome to the Near and Far podcast. I'm your host, Zachary Ellis, and this show is all about embracing curiosity, leaping beyond your comfort zone, and learning from adventurers like yourself who have traveled near and far. We're joined today by our guest, Javier Ochoa Reparez. Javier ran with the bulls in Pamplona, not just once, but then he kept going. He's run with the bulls for about a decade. So welcome to the show, Javier.
Thank you, Zach. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. Thinking back to that very first time you ran with the bulls, what were you feeling in the moments before the bulls started running?
All right, so there are two different ways to do this or to do that. You can do it after you wake up and have a coffee or whatever your preferred morning drink is, and then you walk there and then you do it, or you can continue partying and doing it, which is what I did the first time and the first few times.
So you were partying the night before and the party just kept going and then you ended
exactly
up running with the bulls.
Which is what happens with most people who would do that. So to give you a little bit of context, the festival starts on July 6th and ends on July 14th. And the first run is on July 7th. So we have runs on the 7th, 8th, 9th, and through the 14th, which is the last one. And they're always in the morning at 8 a.m. Now, San Fermín, the festival, the party, it's pretty big, and there's people coming from all over the world to participate and to have some fun. So the bars tend to stay open a lot longer than what they would be during the normal regular year. So they might be open up until 6:30 a.m., and then you basically continue just because at that point it's easy to continue, I guess, if you're still up. So most runners, I don't know if it's most, but many runners end up in the run, in the trail or in the streets where the run happened, will end up after a whole night of partying. And that's exactly what I did for most of my runs when I was young.
So yes. The night before, did you leave the house and start bar hopping in the traditional mozos uniform?
That's the uniform. The uniform, we put it on July 6th, and basically, I mean, you have different clothes. Of course, it's not always the same, but, you know, you have several repetitions of the same uniform. So you use them for an entire week or 9 days. So you're always dressing white. Which actually is not a very old tradition. It happened several decades ago, but for some reason it became popular. And so now if you go to Pamplona during those days, most Pamplona people will dress white and red. So that's what we do. And you just go out with your friends or whoever during the day. Most of the times that continues through the night because it's really fun. And that continues through the morning after you have churros maybe and hot chocolate. And then at around 6:30 or so, and you start, I might run today. So then you start walking to the streets where the runs happen. And then you have to wait for a little bit because the police tend to block the streets. And so you have to get there in time in order to run that day. And then you wait there for about kind of half hour or so, maybe longer, depending where you are in the run. And then they'll shoot a couple of, firework type rockets, you know, to make the sound, to make you aware that that at 8 a.m. the bulls will be released. So the first or the last 20, 30 minutes of that delay or that wait, well, you can either not really knowing where you are if you're a little, if you're having way too much fun, or you start to get really, really worried because, there's a bunch of bulls that are going to start running where you are. And they're all going in the same direction. So those 20, 30 minutes are a little, you get you tend to get nervous basically, and you will see people stretching because it's a run and you sprint. You have to be more or less mentally and physically ready to do it. And then yeah, and then the bulls are released and you're on your own basically against rules and a bunch of people. Yeah.
I always assumed this was more something that people trained for. Do you run faster than the bulls?
Which is
But to you,
true.
it sounds like your experience, it was a lot more spontaneous than that.
Completely. But that's not the, I mean, I have friends or people that I know well in Pamplona. My dad has had friends that have done it for a long time. We all know people in Pamplona, and not only from Pamplona, from elsewhere within the region and Spain, that train for this. That they really are, I mean, they're not professional because no one is paying them, but they act as professionals. So they train for these runs, and those don't party. They'll just go home, they'll sleep, they'll wake up, they'll grab their coffee, and that's that's a good way to do it. Okay. That's a way that you should do it because you're basically facing massive bulls, so you should be prepared and you should be rested and you should, train for it. And many runners do that. But the reality is that many others don't. And if, it's very, very common to basically see people partying and then in an hour or so see them in the run. I mean, which happens, a lot.
What's the closest you've ever been to one of the bulls?
Oh, very close. I mean, I mean, you were right when you were saying that I started running and I've done it for several years. I think I was 17 or so when I did my first one after that those nights of partying. And I think the last time I ran was probably 29 or 28. So during those years, I don't do it if I wouldn't do it every day, but every now and then, two or three times. So several times per all of those years. At the end, you'll have a close encounter because the reality is that there are only a few places where you can actually get off the trail or the run unless you finish way too early, meaning that you make it to the arena before even the bulls are released, which happens with most of those that don't know what is going on. And it probably happened to me those first three times because it's pretty stressful. So you start sprinting as soon as you hear the noise. And by the time the bulls are in the middle of the run, you already finish, which again happens to many runners. So I don't know the proportion. I'd say a big chunk of those runners never run the bulls because they make it to the arena way before the bulls are.
Make
But
it
then
sound
some.
like that you miss out on some of the fun if you get there too safely.
I mean, it all depends on what you consider fun. Because you just might want to to be there with your friends and get this adrenaline rush, but that's it. And you get it because you are in the middle of a street with a bunch of big bulls. So you still get that if you run, if you know exactly what is going on around you after a whole night of partying, of course. But then sometimes you just wait and then you start learning how to wait or where to wait and how to start or when to start running. And I did that a little bit later. So at the end, I was kind of, I went off rail, but at the end, if you stay within the course, the bulls will be at one point very, very next to you, very close to you, because it's a very, very narrow street. And again, as I was saying, there are no really way out. You just basically go to a corner or try to lay down in the ground or you fall because there are so many people that will push you. And you're not supposed to touch the ball in the runs. It's not okay to touch the ball. You have to let them go. But again, the touching, because there's so many people and big bulls with huge horns. The one that I always remember is one that happened one of the last times I did it because I was pushed towards a wall and I hit the wall and then there was a bunch of people on top of me and there was a bull there too. Within the crowd, I guess, just ran over us and I didn't get stepped or anything. That's one of the most common injuries is when a bull steps on you because they have to go somewhere and they have to jump and they're very, very heavy. So that can be very painful. But I never had that issue. But I think that was one of the closest situations where, okay, this is a little stupid, which is stupid anyway.
How dangerous is it? Because I always assumed it was not a safe event, but that was before I realized alcohol was involved.
I mean, alcohol, okay, so there's a little bit of a legal empty space there, because you're not supposed to be under the influence when you're running. And the police will take you out if they see that you are too drunk or... But that...
So you partied responsibly before running.
But it is very difficult for the police to control everybody. So they mostly focus on those that are carrying cameras or something that is big. That's not legal, and they cannot take you out of the run. You can arm someone with a camera. So you cannot do that, although every now and then you'll see it.
So how dangerous is this?
So I can't remember how many people have died over the last 120 years or so, since I think there's been more or less a decent time, basically way to count. And I'm going to say 15, 16 or so. So it's not, the number of deaths is not that high compared. But if you take account all of the runs that happen every year and every year, but the number of injuries is high. So every year there will be people that are harmed. Not every day, perhaps, but yeah. So there might be four or five people that get severely harmed per year. And then many other minor injuries, like fractures, or maybe you hit the face, the ground, and then you start bleeding or whatever it is. That's very, very common. But Pamplona has, and you know that also happens in other parts of Spain, that there are other places with runs. But Pamplona in particular, basically the hospitals that have created in order to avoid delays is extremely good. So you get horned, you start getting treated right there in the street, and within minutes you're in a hospital. It's very, very efficient. And I'm sure that has saved many, many lives throughout the last years.
And obviously getting horned is about the most salient thing that people think about when it comes to injuries here, but you said you ended up falling and people were running over you. And
yeah, so I've never had big issues other than scratches, but again, I'm not, even though I run it multiple times, that's nothing compared to people running every day for every year. And we all in Pamplona know somebody who does that. The more often you do it, the higher the chances are, right? Even if you're very, very good, lots of things that you cannot control, mostly because of the people or how slippery things are or whatever. So at one point, yeah, you'll have an issue. Mm-hmm.
What's more dangerous, the bulls, the people, or the street itself?
Well, the street itself, it used to be I'm not going to say pretty slippery. It used to be a little slippery when it would rain or when they would clean the streets. But now they use a solution that makes it anti-slippery. So the street itself is not that difficult anymore, other than the fact that, again, it's a very, very narrow street with walls and it's hard to get off. People, for sure, depending on the day, the weekends are massive, really, in terms of crowds. Saturday, Sundays are extremely busy. So you can encounter issues those days, depending on the type of bulls that are run. The organizers also control that. There are some ranches or farms or bulls that are known for they're easier to run with people. They don't really go against people. They just go with them, while others are a little bit more, let's say, nervous, and they go left and right. So they control the type of bull that runs over the really busy weekend days. But to your question, I mean, obviously a bull is... Per se, it's more dangerous than a human being, right? Because it's I don't know how many times heavier, and the horns. But again, most of the times you're going to be around the people. And for seconds, you'll be, if you are a very good runner, which I was not, you'll be running in front of the bull. So then at that point, but at the same time, you're going to have to start jumping people and maybe fighting with elbows, others. So it's a combination of both. I don't know which one I would say it's more dangerous in terms of number of injuries. I would probably say that the crowds may cause more injuries than the bulls, but the injuries caused by the bulls are heavier and bigger and more dangerous, if that makes sense.
So you're going to get that adrenaline rush wherever you are.
Wherever you are, and even if you watch it, there are balconies all over the run. And you'll hear screams when people basically people are screaming when they see the bulls coming, and you can actually feel the sound. It's just it's very primitive. It really is. It's a kind of a stupid thing. It's a stupid, it's a stupid tradition, but it's so inherited within the nature of the city that it's you know, people yeah, it's they feel it very, very deep inside. And yeah, so regardless you're running or outside watching it, the adrenaline levels go up, I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
How'd the tradition get started? Because I know San Fermín was not known for bulls, right?
No. So San Fermín is a saint, of course, and it's one of the cities, I don't know how that's said in English, you know, it's one of the two sides of the city, basically. The tradition started after or around a fair, like a cattle fair. And the tradition that cattle fair was around that religious day, basically, which, by the way, used to happen in a different time of the year. But the weather was so bad that they moved it to July, because I think it used to be in the fall when it was rainy and the weather can be pretty bad in Pamplona. So they moved it to July. But anyways, so it was around, it all started around that fair with cattle. And it's, you know, bulls in the Spanish peninsula in Spain are very, very common everywhere. So there used to be bullfights. And the bullfight in Pamplona was in the center of the city. So they would have to move the bulls from outside the city to downtown, which is very narrow and small and, you know, packed. And that's where the bullfight would be. So the tradition started like, well, let's move the bulls to the arena. And then somebody decided to start running them. And I think that's how it started, but I'm not an expert, but that's the story that I've always heard in Pamplona. Yeah.
In just a moment, let's come back and talk more about Pamplona, which is one of the larger cities in the Basque region of Spain, and Basque culture is just so interesting. So many delicious foods originated out of there, and we'll be right back. If you're enjoying the show so far, don't keep it a secret. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Reviews help people find episodes like this one where they can learn from other travelers and come along for the journey. Now back to the show. Javier, Pamplona is part of the Basque region of Spain, but it isn't part of what's called Basque country. So, for those who don't know, what exactly is Basque culture?
Okay. It's an important and tricky question to answer. It requires some background. The first thing I'll say, though, Pamplona is the capital of the region of Navarra. Navarra is a region within Spain that was its own kingdom for centuries, which was completely independent from any other kingdom within Spain or France. It maintained, what would you say, privileges that some of them are actually retained over up until now.
So is it semi-autonomous or...?
It's not semi-autonomous, but we collect our own taxes, for example, just to give you an idea. But Navarra, the region, was militarily conquered by Castilla and Aragon, which was part of Spain at that time in 1512. So for about 300 years, it was a country within a country, basically. So that's Pamplona and that's Navarra, which is not officially part of the Basque country itself. The Basque country, or it's also called the Euskadi, is a region in Spain with three provinces. Vizcaya, Guipúzcoa, and Álava. Vizcaya is where Bilbao is, Guipúzcoa is where San Sebastián is, and then Álava, the capital of Álava, is Vitoria or Gasteiz. And that's the official Basque country within Spain. So the Basque culture is different. And the Basque culture is defined by the language, which is Basque or Euskera. So those that are considered Euskaldun means that those are the ones that speak the language, Basque, okay? So that culture, and not it's not only the language, of course, there are some cultural uniquenesses in terms of the traditions that the Basque community has that are slightly different or many or in some cases very different to the communities that are around the Basque region. So Pamplona is within that area in Navarra with big Basque influence, although it's a big city. And a big, it's bigger than other little towns around the region. It's about two, it's kind of like the size of Boise, actually.
Boise, Idaho.
Boise, Idaho.
Yeah.
So about 200,000 or so, with other cities around. And within that population, there's a small fraction of those that speak Basque speaking the language, is relatively low to compare to northern parts of the region. So, for example, where my parents are from, it's a little valley in the northern part of Navarra. I would say 95% of people speak Basque. Okay. And it's not officially part of the Basque country, it's part of Navarra. But then many others don't speak Basque in my region. So the southern part of Navarra, they speak Spanish. And many of them, most of them, probably don't consider themselves Basque because they don't really have a Basque culture. Okay. So it's a little confusing. But again, if you are in the north part of Navarra, the Basque influence is huge. And I would say over 90% of people will, or 85 or whatever it is, will actually consider themselves Basque. So I myself consider a Basque from Navarra. That's what I consider myself, yeah, because I speak Basque.
Okay, and how many languages are, is Basque in one of the official languages of Spain?
Yeah. So Spain has, well, obviously Spanish, then they have Galician, or we have Galician, Catalan, Basque, and those are co-official languages. Okay.
And they're separate distinct languages, not just dialects of one another.
Yeah, those are considered languages, and there are a few other dialects, and the most different one, or the really different one, is Basque, because it's not a Latin type language. Galician is its own language. And Catalan is its own language, but if you're from Spain, you can get some, you can get some words and you can get to understand more or less the context of the conversation, I think. But if you go to one of those small villages in the Basque country or the Basque region of Navarra, the chance you'll understand nothing, really.
You mentioned Boise, Idaho, real quick, which, for those who don't know, I believe it has the largest Basque population outside of Spain. Is that
Yeah,
correct?
that's
And
correct.
in downtown Boise, there's a Basque district with some absolutely amazing restaurants. If you're ever in the area, definitely swing by and try some Basque food. What makes Basque cuisine different from cuisine elsewhere in that part of Spain?
Well,
Or is
I'm
there a
gonna say,
difference?
yeah, I'm gonna say that my only, I'm only good cooking sangria, so I'm not the best person to talk about cooking, but what I think it is, although I do come from a family that owns a Basque restaurant in the Basque region of Navarra, so I've been exposed to really, really good food my entire life, but I have never learned how to do it myself. I honestly think that the main difference is the quality of the produce. Okay, so the and there are some recipes that are part of the region, but I think what defines the traditional Basque cuisine is the quality of what they use, and it tends to be simpler than any than other cuisines, but it's just good quality. So if you're gonna get a good steak is a big thing, or lamb is a big thing in the Basque region, Basque country. Fish is extremely important in the Basque culture and the Basque country because it's basically right there. The Basque country has a big portion of it is in the coast. So fish is big, seafood as well, vegetables, and I don't know. Again, I'm not an expert in I'm not a kitchen person that much, but I really think that what it defines the Basque cuisine is the quality of what it's served.
And did Basque people invent chorizo? Am I remembering that right?
So chorizo is very, very common in Spain. So there are many other regions in Spain that have really, really good chorizos. In the south, chorizos are incredibly good. I don't know if you are familiar with jamón and jabugo in the south of Spain. It's ham. It's kind of like prosciutto, Italian prosciutto, but really, really good. So they also make their own chorizo. So it's not a Basque only thing at all. Now, in the Basque country, chorizo is big, and we have different versions of it. And my mom, for example, is from a little town called Arbizu, which is known for its own type of chorizo, which is called chistorra. Chistorra is all, it's very, very common within, particularly in Navarra. But that little town is called for its own chistorra. And chistorra is just a thinner type of chorizo with a bunch of paprika, and it's really, really good. It's one of my favorite things.
I'm gonna have to make it over there and try some.
No, you can actually eat it here. Well, there, if you are in Boise, those that are able to travel to Boise, you can find a couple of places where chistorras are made really, really well. I can give you some hints.
What do you do for fun in Pamplona when the Bulls aren't running? I take it you're a fan of the Osasuna football team?
Yeah, Osasuna. Yes, of course. Yes, football is one of my... I played football for most of my youth in school and also with my friends outside school. So that was one of my hobbies when I was growing up. Pamplona is a pretty safe place, so it was always fun to just get on the bike and mess around as any other kid will do. Going out with my friends when we got a little older, that was, you know, for years was my number one hobby, I guess, that we would have a lot of fun. But yeah,
just also going around being a kid.
Yeah, yes, of course. And then, yes, football is watching football, going to the stadium, to Osasuna's stadium was a big part of my childhood. I would go with my dad and my uncle first, and then I started going with one of my cousins, and I did that for many, many years. And then with a good friend as well, we would go every weekend or basically every game it would happen in Pamplona. The stadium is at a walking distance from anywhere in Pamplona, so it was really easy and it was affordable at times. Then it got a little more expensive. But anyways, it's fun. I really like it. I'm a huge Osasuna fan. I'm not an ultra or one of those hooligans. I'm not like that, but I really follow the team. And yeah,
does Navarra have a ton of football hooliganism?
Well, Pamplona and Osasuna is the only professional team in Navarra. So those that are hooligans are going to be part of the Osasuna crowd. And there is a group that has been notorious for their hooliganism in Pamplona's Osasuna's crowd. It's called Indarkorri. And they've been functioning I was a teenager or so when they started. So they've been going on for the last 30 years or so. I don't like them that much, but anyways, I'm not gonna go there because sometimes they are hooligans, so you know they do things that you shouldn't do. Yeah.
Even though some American teams definitely have reputations for more unruly fan bases, I think the culture of hooliganism is something that we've luckily avoided, at least much over here.
I agree with you. I think one of the differences is that the hooliganism in Europe is basically organized. And it's not only organized, it's also influenced by politics in many different ways.
Really?
So if you look at the list of hooligans within Spanish teams or the Basque Country teams, you can clearly define the politics of each of them.
So are there communist hooligans, fascist hooligans?
You could definitely separate things like that. You can have hooligans that promote the independence of the Basque Country, for example. And perhaps a big chunk of those Indarkorri or Osasuna fans want that. Okay. But then you also have hooligans in Madrid that are more towards the far right. At least they were. I don't know the situation right now, but when I was growing up, there was the big group.
Remember you telling me about going to football games in other cities when your team would be on the road? The reputation around Basque separatism would impact how people treated
Yeah,
fans while they were
absolutely.
visiting.
Yeah, yes. So that happened in the 90s. I was getting into my 20s in the middle of the 90s. But anyways, that's when I would go out and or go on and travel a few times, so travel every now and then with my team, and most of the times with my uncle, with my cousin, and a couple of friends. And that's the 90s was a pretty harsh time in Spain, considering or when taking into consideration the Basque separatism and the Basque terrorist group that used to be, effectively, basically functioning and killing people in Spain. So, because of that association that everybody does between the hooliganism in soccer and football and politics, Osasuna's hooligans would be completely 100% associated with the Basque separatism and terrorism. So even though you were not travel with them, they would normally travel with on their own with their own bus, but you would be with the crowd of Osasuna. So I've every now and then you would get comments, and somebody would insult you and things like that based on where you're from and the fact that you are supporting Osasuna, which I guess I mean it's what it is. It happened the same thing in Pamplona when other teams get to the city. They will probably somebody who has nothing to do with their hooligans will be affected by it. Sometimes we had to run because in the streets because those that are part of the hooligan team would start throwing stones to the police, and I was there, so then we
No.
have to stay away from it. But I was never part of that hooliganism, but I was directly affected every now and then. Yeah.
So, when you were growing up, the separatist terrorists were conducting bombings and other acts of violence. What was it like being around that during your formative years?
So you are a kid. You're I mean, let's say that you're 12, 13, 14, 16. You start going out with your friends at 17 or so. And then you realize once it's not happening, you realize that you get used to that, which is terrible. It shouldn't be there. But you live within an environment that makes you get used to that violence. And you would and there would be violence in every different aspect. There would be violence when you were watching the news, and every week or so there would be a bombing in Madrid or in Barcelona, and they would kill a bunch of people. Or there would be somebody that was shot in Bilbao or San Sebastian or Pamplona, and you would listen to that and another one. But so there was so much violence that I guess you get trapped. So it's interesting to think about that when there's no violence and how
So you
horrible
were
that is.
desensitized to it and it was just normalized?
There's so much of it, and there's also a lot of fear within the environment because you don't want to speak up. I mean, if you are part of a small community and you are against that terrorism, but you know that you are surrounded by a bunch of people that support it, there's a lot of fear on that. So there's a combination of desensitization and also active avoidance because of fear. And that still happens in some small places. I mean, I honestly think that the problem is still there. The fear is still there. So there will be many generations to pass before that is over. Yeah, so we would go out with our friends, and my friend and I, we never, I mean, the only thing we wanted to do is have some fun, really. We were never involved on anything like that. But sometimes we would just have to run because the police was on one side and the separatists supporters were on the other side, and while they were throwing stones and the other was shooting rubber balls or so it was an act. I mean, it was almost a very violent situation that we had to live with it for many years as we were growing up. And then I mean, there are events that I still keep in my mind because I remember when we were 13 or so, somebody from my school was killed, a kid. And I think he was a couple of years older than I was, or maybe 3 years older. But he was killed because the terrorist put a bomb in his front door, because there's somebody else living within that building, and they wanted to kill that person, but they ended up killing the kid. I don't remember if that other person was dead, was killed as well, but the kid died in that acting, in that terrorist acting. So, and so, you know, so you live in that environment. It's, how is it that you were able to do that? Desensitization, and in some cases, a fear, I think, for many, was a big, big chunk of it. Yeah, and sorry, I'll give you another example. I remember one of my friends had an American high school kid visiting, you know, exchange program to spend a couple of months in Pamplona to learn Spanish. And we took him out one summer night, and we were having some fun. And we were just in one bar and another one. And drinking age was it's still 18, and I think it was already 18 when we were growing up, but you know, you can still go out and have a couple of beers, and that's what we were doing. And I remember getting off a bar with my friends and this kid, I don't remember his name, and there was a bus on fire right in front of us, a real bus on fire because of the violence. And this kid was like, what is going on here? I mean, he was really scared. And we were just, oh, yeah, you know, another one, you know. So that's the difference. Somebody who's not exposed to it is terrified. And us, it's not that we're braver. We're not. We're just used to it. And it's very sad.
Weren't on that bus.
Well, they remove the people. So they want to set the fire, the bus on fire. That way they can use it as a barricade or basically to act, you know, to make it, to make themselves noticeable. Yeah, it was a hard time, and everybody knows people that support them, the terrorists, I mean. And it's, and I honestly think that that's a problem that is going to last. Even though there's no terrorism anymore, there's enough support, which, you know, I mean, whatever they support with violence, I'm not going to support whatever it is. I don't care.
So even though the ideology is still there, the will for a separatist movement, and the fear is still definitely there from people who remember what that could devolve into.
I think so.
It's been a long time since there's been widespread violence regarding these political motivations, right? So what changed since now it is a safe place for tourists to go, and what changed?
It's a safe place for a tourist to go. I think it's fear is still present in those smaller communities, those that think differently, don't want to speak up. For anyone else visiting, it's extremely safe. It's very safe. I think what happened, or maybe about 20 years ago or so, 16, 17, something, I don't remember exactly where the terrorist group dismantled, 2010 or something. I don't remember. I think what happened is that they even realized that they were not going anywhere with it, and that they had to use politics in order to gain something, because they did. I mean, there's a city in Spain not far away from Pamplona. It's called Zaragoza. They put a bomb in one of the grocery stores. So, and they killed 20-something people. No, that was in Barcelona, not in Zaragoza. So how can you get something if you something that like that that is so horrible? So they realize, I guess they slowly realized that they were not going anywhere with it. And also, police was getting really, really good at catching them. So they also realized, well, we are not going anywhere, and at the same time, we ended up in jail. So let's get moving, and let's move into politics, which is the current situation, which I guess possibly because of completely different reasons, because I don't know enough. But that's pretty much what happened with Sinn Féin and in Ireland. You know, there's the politic arm of the of the of the team or the group gained power and it became just the only thing. And same thing happened in the Basque Country. But it's, yeah, still, the problem is still there. It's, I don't think it's gone.
Now that they realize violence isn't wasn't working, and now that it is a safer place for tourists to go, let's come back in a moment, and I want to hear about Pamplona of today, and it sounds like you might have some good tips for navigating the city if you're in search of good sangria, good food, good fun. So many places to go, so many things to see. Wherever you are, make it easy to find more interviews like this one. Near and Far's free monthly newsletter will keep you up to speed about the latest podcast episodes, as well as our hand-picked recommendations. That's only one email per month. To sign up, simply follow the link in the show notes or head over to www.nearandfar.travel/newsletter. I've read a lot about how Barcelona has been dealing with overcrowding. They are putting in new regulations about Airbnbs because tourists are flooding into the non-touristy parts of town. I think I've read about wanting to put limits on how many cruise ship passengers can come in, and the lines at the Sagrada Familia, you can wait hours just to go in and see the cathedral. But Pamplona doesn't necessarily have those same tourist overcrowding problems, does it?
No, not at all. I was in Barcelona a couple of 3 years ago, and it was as a tourist, and it was really, it's shocking the amount of people that go there. So it's not that I support the actions against those that are visiting places just for fun, but I understand the locals too. Pamplona has no issue like that. It gets very crowded during the festival, but the rest of the year it's a very, very peaceful place. We do have, Pamplona is part of the El Camino, the pilgrim way, very, very popular in Europe and elsewhere, where people walk for about 600 kilometers or so, or actually more, maybe about 600 miles in 2 months or whatever it is. So Pamplona is part of one of the cities within one of the routes there. So we get that kind of tourism. We also get weekend tourism from France and other cities in the Basque Country or in the rest of Spain. But we don't have that issue at all. Yeah, but yes, it's a very, very shocking situation in big cities in Spain, Sevilla, Granada, Cordoba. Yeah, they're massified by tourism.
If I were to visit, what could I do to be one of the good tourists? What can I do to be a respectful tourist?
Yeah, I think we talked about this the other day. I think it is important to adapt and to blend. Basically, look around and see how people behave, and you don't have
to
be super.
Basically, pretend you're not a tourist.
Pretend you're not a tourist. I think it's the best way to do tourism, because then you might be getting to places that you were not expecting just by following those that are local. I mean, and you might go two or three streets in, and you might find a very, very small tapas place that, or pinchos place that you didn't know, because it's not in your book, the tourist book. So I think it also will avoid you some issues, because, pickpockets, for instance, in Barcelona, Madrid, and big cities, they are always looking for tourists. So if you don't want to have an issue, don't look like a tourist and pretend you are a local. And sometimes it's really hard, depending where you are. But I think it's a good strategy, and I definitely try to do that when I travel.
What can someone who looks like me do to look more like a local?
They might notice, he's not from around here, but he might be living here. You might study there, or you might be working there. That doesn't make you a tourist. I don't know. Don't open the map like this in the front of everybody. There are a few things that you can do. And also, everybody should be very respectful with whatever we see around us, which is probably also a good way to learn about the way people live. in those places. Yeah.
Yeah, the idea to not act like a tourist, when you truly immerse yourself in wherever you are, there's the expression, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. You learn so much about why people there do, act the way they do.
I guess everything depends on the way that your trip is organized. So if you have a week and you are supposed to visit four different cities, that's a very different situation. And I have a week, but I'm just going to pick one of those cities. I'm going to get an apartment. And then I have a whole week to walk around. Maybe I'll repeat the same coffee shop because I like it. And that's kind of like basically what a local, that's the type of traveling that I like. So every now and then we'll do these shorter trips where you visit different, and it is harder to pretend that you're not a tourist when you're in that situation, right? Because then you have, I have, these four iconic places that I want to visit within the city. I personally, and sometimes it's difficult because I don't travel by myself, but I personally prefer to go to one and avoid the other two and basically walk around. And I don't have to see everything. I prefer to get a sense of the place and avoid going to the cathedral if it's not. I mean, sometimes it's really hard because the cathedral is spectacular and, you want to watch it, you want to see it. But I'd rather go to the cathedral and not to the cathedral and these other four places and use that time to walk around or even sit at a table outside having a beer and looking, because I really like people watching, basically. So that's what I like about traveling.
Yeah.
Yes.
The way I see it, every moment that I spend waiting in line for something is a moment that I'm not enjoying local food.
Yeah, that too. Yeah, that too. It's just, I guess it's a different type of strategy when traveling, but sometimes it's as hard to do it, depending on the time. But for example, I'll give you an example. One of the most common way for me to travel is when I go to a conference. And the conference lasts, for work, it lasts 2 or 3 days, but I'll stay 2 more days. And I don't visit anything. I know some people say, well, you didn't go to this thing? No. So what did you do? Nothing. I just stay, but I like it. I mean, when I talk to others, how did you end up not going to the Louvre, the museum, or to the ball? Because I'm sure it's really nice, but I have other priorities and I'd rather stay and walk around and sit and have a beer or two or a coffee than wait in line. I hate waiting in line.
Sometimes if I'll schedule flights with long layovers so that I can spend, let's say, 16 hours in a city. That's how I ended up in Paris, and instead of spending like all of my hours at the Louvre, my wife and I hung out in the Montmartre district and just drank wine, ate croissants, and it was a much better time than elbowing through people trying to see the Mona Lisa.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've done that a lot too, in London and in Reykjavik in Iceland too. I just stayed overnight there. They have a program, Icelander. You can do that for the same price. And a few other cities, they stay longer or basically make the layover longer to do that. Yeah, it's a good way to do it.
I think the Iceland government actually encourages Icelandair to make it easy for you to have long layovers. You can either spend the day in Reykjavik. You should be able to schedule it. You used to be able to schedule layovers for 3 or 4 days so that you could also drive around Iceland's Golden Circle, see a bunch of famous waterfalls, the national park where you can see the continental rift. And I just love traveling like that.
Yeah, no. Yes, I know that they might have a day limit, but they encourage to get a long layover in Reykjavik.
Speaking of travel tips, when in Spain, I think am I remembering right? You've told me before that if you go into a restaurant, the bar is on the first floor, and that's where all of the tourists hang out and order appetizers and stuff. But where do you go for the really good food?
Well, it happens sometimes, not in all restaurants, but sometimes there's depending on the restaurant, you'll find a front bar where it's really packed, and then and it's often there's often a second living room or dining room, basically dining room with where with the tables and the restaurant are located. So you can find that, for example, we were in Madrid last December and we were just wandering around where to eat. It was really busy because it was during Christmas time. Yeah, and we found one of those where the restaurant was fine, but then looking at the bar itself, where everybody was having tapas, it was just impossible. So you look around, because there's always, not always, but there's a possibility that there's going to be a quieter place inside that not everybody knows. The locals will, but not the tourists. Yeah.
How would I ask for that place? How would I go about asking to get to that part of the restaurant?
Well, you can ask, or you can start walking around. And then if somebody tells you, where are you going? I'll go, okay. Yeah, you can do it. I mean, it's fine. It's a it's a local place. I mean, it's a public space, not public, but you can get in, I guess. So you just walk around, and if they tell you, hey, well, that's, you're not supposed to be here. Well, okay. Well, you'll probably understand, even if it is in a different language. But you can ask, yeah, you can ask if there's another section for the restaurant. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Circling back, going all the way back to running with the bulls, you haven't just run with bulls, right? What other animals have you run with, Javier?
So, yeah. So when I moved to the U.S. in 2005, and my first place was Bozeman in Montana. Mm-hmm. So I think it was my first summer there with, I met some friends and we started exploring Montana. And on one of those trips, we randomly found a little town called Reed Point, which is not far from Bozeman. And they are known for the running of the sheep.
The sheep,
yeah. In Reed Point, Montana, there would be sheep, and then there would be people dressed up like somebody from Pamplona, white and red, in front of the sheep. So they were pleased to learn that I was actually from Pamplona, and some people took pictures with me. So I was the real tourist there. And, oh, okay. But they found that really fun. And then, not so long ago...
Did any of the sheep have horns?
No. No. But there were many of them.
What about fake horns? Did they?
No fake horns. But there were many of them. So if you fall, you might be in trouble. It was really safe. But it was a fun part.
Is the night before running with the sheep also filled with sangria?
I don't know that part, because we were there for the day, but the bars were packed during the day. So maybe not sangria, but other beverages for sure. We're running around. Yes. We had a good time. And then... not so long ago, less than 2 months ago, I was at a conference in Anchorage and my flight got canceled. And I started asking around what to do. And basically, it was the beginning of the dog sled competition. I don't remember the name of it.
Iditarod, is that the
one? Iditarod, yeah, Iditarod. That was so it would start in Anchorage that day. So I was watching it, and I met these people who were watching it with me and say, oh, I said, geez, I was looking at my phone. I said, my flight got canceled. I have to stay overnight here. And I said, well, you can run the reindeer.
Run the reindeer.
So, yeah. So I ended up running the reindeer that day after a couple of beers. Yeah.
Do they just release a bunch of reindeer? And
yeah, they do. A bunch. So it's I don't remember the street, but it's the main street in downtown Anchorage. And then there's a bunch of people running, many of them wearing costumes, dressed up.
Costumes, right?
There's one person dressed up as Pamplona runner. And I actually talked to him, and I wish I had taken a picture with him. He was there. He told me that he was in Pamplona last summer. So he was dressed up. So they basically have they separate the runners into groups of four or five groups to make it a little more manageable. And then the reindeer, they basically circle around and they run again. and it's they are coming from a farm, and some of them are missing one. I mean, it was fun. It was a good time. I had a good time, but completely unexpected because I was supposed to be flying at that time, and I ended up running the reindeer.
Well, both running with the sheep, running with the reindeer, those seem like good entry-level events for people who are considering running with the bulls someday.
It is. It's pretty much the same thing. It's a human and another animal behind, just the animal is different. But yes.
This has all been fantastic. You've been living a really fun life, Javier, and thanks for sharing your travel wisdom with us today.
Thank you, Zach. I don't know if we talk too much about travel, but it's fine.
Well, travel, Pamplona, this has been a lot of fun. And thank you for listening to the Near and Far podcast. If you liked this conversation, don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your fellow explorers. You can find more episodes like this on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and www.nearandfar.travel. Or wherever you enjoy your favorite podcasts. I'm your host, Zachary Ellis. Stay curious, stay adventuring, and stay exploring, near and far.